High poinsettia bushes pelted by the rain, and soggy children's toys abandoned in driveways paved with parallel strips of concrete. The level of maintenance here seemed erratic, but the address I now had for Bertha Christopher showed one of the better-kept houses on the block, mustard-colored with dark brown trim. I parked my VW on the opposite side of the street about 50 yards away, so I could sit and watch the place inconspicuously. Most of the parked cars were crummy, so mine fit right in. It was now after 5 o'clock, and the light was fading fast, the chill in the air more pronounced. The rain had eased somewhat, so I left my umbrella where it was. I grabbed my yellow slicker and slipped into it, pulling up the hood. I locked the car and crossed the street, splashing through puddles that darkened the leather of my boots. The rain drummed against the fabric of the slicker with a pocking sound that made me feel like I was in a pup tent. The Christopher property was surrounded by a low rock wall, constructed with sandstone boulders the size of cantaloupes, held together with concrete. A row of hanging planters screened the front windows from the street, and a set of glass wind chimes suspended in one corner of the porch tinkled with the wind. There were two lightweight aluminum lawn chairs arranged on either side of a metal table. Everything was soggy and smelled of wet grass. There was no doorbell, but I tapped on the pane of glass in the front window, cupping a hand so I could peer in. The interior was in shadow, no light showing from the rear of the house. I moved to the porch rail and checked the adjacent houses, both of which were dark. My guess was that many of these people were off at work. After a few minutes, I went back to my car. I started the engine and ran the heater for a while, fogging up the windows until I could barely see. I rubbed a clear spot in the middle of the windshield and then sat and stared. Street lights came on. At 5:45, I ate my sandwich just for something to do. At 6:15, I drank some coffee and flipped on my car radio, listening to a talk show host interview a psychic. 15 minutes later, right after the 6:30 news, a car approached and slowed, turning into the Christopher's driveway. A woman got out, dimly illuminated by the streetlight. She paused as if to raise her umbrella, and then apparently decided to make a dash for it. I watched her scuttle up the driveway and around toward the back of the house. Moments later, the lights went on in sequence. First, the rear left room, probably a kitchen, then the living room, and finally the front porch light. I gave her a few minutes to get her coat hung up, and then I returned to her front door. I knocked again. I could see her peer into the hallway from the rear of the house, and then approach the front door. She stared at me blankly, then leaned her head close to the glass for a better look. She appeared to be in her 50s, with a sallow complexion and a deeply creased face. Her hair was too uniform a shade to be a natural brown. She wore it parted on the side, with big puffy bangs across her lined forehead. Her eyes were the size and color of old pennies, and her makeup looked like it needed renewing at this hour of the day. She wore a uniform I'd seen before, brown pants and a brown and yellow check tunic. I couldn't place the outfit offhand. "Yes?" she called through the glass. I raised my voice against the sound of the rain. "I'm looking for Billy. Is he back yet?"
"He don't live here, hun, but he said he'd be by at 8 o'clock. Who are you?"
I picked a name at random.
"Charlene. Are you his mother?"
"Charlene who?"
"A friend of his said I should look him up if I was ever in Santa Teresa. Is he at work?"
She gave me an odd look, as if the notion of Billy working had never crossed her mind.
"He's out checking the used car lots for an automobile."
She had one of those faces that seemed tantalizingly familiar, and it dawned on me belatedly that she was a checker at the supermarket where I shop now and then. We'd even chatted idly about the fact that I was a PI. I eased back out of the porch light, hoping she hadn't recognized me at the same time I recognized her. I held the corner of the slicker up as though to shield my face from the wind. She seemed to pick up on the fact that something odd was going on.
"What did you want him for?"
I ignored that, pretending I couldn't hear.
"Why don't I come back when he gets home?" I hollered. "Just tell him Charlene stopped by, and I'll catch up with him when I can."
"Well, all right," she said reluctantly. I gave her a casual wave as I turned. I went down the porch steps and into the dark, aware that she was peering after me suspiciously. I must have disappeared from her field of vision then, because she turned the porch light off. I got back in my car with one of those quick involuntary shudders that racks you from head to toe. When I caught up with Billy, I might well admit who I was and what I wanted with him, but for the moment I didn't want to tip my hand. I checked my watch and settled in, prepared to wait. Already it was feeling like a long night. Chapter 8. 4 hours passed. The rain stopped. It became apparent that Billy was not only late, but possibly not coming at all. Maybe he'd bought a car and hightailed it out of town, or maybe at some point he'd phoned his mother and decided to skip the visit when he heard about Charlene. I finished all the coffee in the thermos, my brain fairly crackling from caffeine. If I smoked cigarettes, I could have gone through a pack. Instead, I listened to 8 more installments of the news, the farm report, and an hour of Hispanic music. I pondered the possibility of learning the Spanish language by simply listening to these gut-wrenching tunes. I thought about Jonah and the husbands I'd known. Surely if my heart broke again, it would sound just like this, though for all I knew, the lyrics were about cutworms and inguinal hernias, matters only made soulful through soaring harmonies. Altogether, I came perilously close to boring myself insensible with my own mental processes, so it was with real relief that I saw the car approach and pull into the curb in front of the house across the street. It looked like a 1967 Chevrolet, white with a temporary registration sticker on the windshield. I couldn't tell much about the guy who got out, but I watched with interest as he took the porch steps in 2 bounds and rang the bell. Betty Christopher came to the door to let him in. The two of them disappeared. A moment later, shadows wavered against the kitchen light. I figured they'd sit down for a couple of beers and a heart-to-heart talk. The next thing I knew, however, the front door opened again and he came out. I slipped down on the car seat until my eyes were level with the bottom of the window. The cloud cover was still heavy, obscuring the moon, and the cars along the curb created deeper shadows still. He stared out at the street, taking in the line of parked cars one by one. I felt my heart start to thump as I watched him come down the steps and head in my direction. He paused in the middle of the street. He moved over to a van, parked 2 cars away from mine. He flicked on a flashlight and opened the door on the driver's side, apparently to check the registration. I lost sight of him. Moments went by. I watched the shadows, wondering if he'd crept around the other side and was coming up on my right. I heard a muffled sound as he closed the door to the van. The beam from his flashlight swept over the car in front of me and flashed across my windshield, the light too diffused by the time it reached me to illuminate much. He flicked it off. He waited, scanning the street on both sides. Apparently, he decided there was nothing to worry about. He crossed back to the house. As he reached the porch, she came out, clutching a robe around her. They talked for a few minutes, and then he got in his car and took off. The minute she went inside, I started the VW and did a big U-turn following. I hoped this wasn't all some elaborate ruse to flush me into the open. He had already made a left turn and then a right by the time I caught sight of him 2 blocks ahead of me. We were driving along the back streets with no traffic lights at all, and only an occasional stop sign to slow our progress. I had to close the gap or risk losing him. A one-man tale is nearly pointless unless you know who you're following and where he's going, to begin with. At this hour, there were very few cars on the road, and if he drove far, he'd realize the presence of my VW was no accident. I thought he was headed toward the freeway, but before he reached the northbound on-ramp, he slowed and made a right-hand turn. By then, I was only half a block back, so I whipped over to the curb and parked, killing the engine. I locked the car and took off on foot, heading diagonally across the corner lot at a dead run. I caught sight of his taillights half a block ahead. The car was making a left-hand turn into a shabby trailer park. Puente is a narrow street that parallels Highway 101 on the east side of town, with the trailer park itself squeezed into the space between the 2 roadways, screened off from the highway by a 10-foot board fence and masses of oleander. I was covering ground at a quick clip. The houses I passed were dark, driveways crowded with old cars, most of them sporting dents. The street lighting here was poor, but ahead of me I caught traces of light from the trailer park, which was strung with small multicolored bulbs. By the time I got to the entrance, there was no sign of the Chevrolet, but the place was small, and I didn't think the car would be hard to spot. The road twisting through the trailer park was 2 lanes wide. The blacktop still glistened from the rain, and water was dripping from the eucalyptus trees that towered at intervals. There were signs posted everywhere: slow, speed bumps, tenant parking only, do not block driveway. Most of the trailers were single wides, 15 to 20 feet long, the kind that once upon a time you could actually hitch to your car and travel in. Nomad, Airstream, and Concorde seemed to predominate. Each had a numbered cardboard sign in the window, indicating the number of the lot on which it sat. Some were moored in narrow patches of grass, temporary camper spaces for RVs passing through, but many were permanent, and by the look of them had been there for years. The lots were stingy squares of poured concrete, surrounded by sections of white picket fence 2 feet high, or separated from one another by sagging lengths of bamboo matting. The yards, when they existed, harbored an assortment of plastic deer and flamingos. It was almost 11, and many of the trailers were dark. Occasionally, I could see the blue-gray flicker of a TV set. I found the Chevrolet, hood warm, the engine still ticking, parked beside a dark green battered trailer with a torn awning and half the aluminum skirting ripped away. From inside, I could hear the dull thump of rock and roll music being played too loudly in too small a space. The trailer windows were ovals of hot yellow light, positioned about a foot higher than eye level. I edged around to the right-hand side, easing in as close as I could, checking the area to see if any of the neighbors had spotted me. The trailer next door had a for-rent sign taped to the siding, and the one across the lane had the curtains pulled. I turned back to the window and got up on tiptoe, peering in. The window was open slightly, and the air seeping out was hot and smelled of fried onions. The curtains consisted of old cotton dish towels with a brass rod threaded through one end, hanging crookedly enough to provide a clear view of Billy Polo and the woman he was talking to. They were both seated at a flop-down table in the galley, drinking beer, mouths working, words inaudible in the thumping din of music. The interior of the trailer was a depressing collage of cheap paneled walls, dirty dishes, junk, torn upholstery, newspaper, and canned goods stacked on countertops. A bumper sticker pasted above the front door said, "I've been to all 48 states." There was a small black-and-white television set perched on a cardboard box, tuned to what looked like the tag end of a prime-time private eye show. The action was speeding up. A car careened out of control, flipping end over end before it went off a cliff, exploding in mid-air. The picture cut to two men in an office, one talking on the phone. Neither Billy nor his companion seemed to be watching, and the music must have made it impossible for them to hear the dialogue anyway. I could feel a cramp forming in my right calf. I cast about for something to stand on to ease the strain. The yard next door was a jungle of overgrown shrubs, the parking space choked with discards. There was a set of detached wooden steps tucked up under the trailer door. I blundered through the bushes, my jeans and boots getting drenched in the process. I was counting on the thunder of music to cover the sound of my labors as I hefted the box steps, tramped back through the shrubs, and set the steps under the window. Cautiously I mounted, peering in again. Billy Polo had a surprisingly boyish face for a man who'd lived his 30 years as a thug. His hair was dark, a curly mass standing out around his face. His nose was small, his mouth generous, and he had a dimple in his chin that looked like a puncture wound. He wasn't a big man, but he had a wiry musculature that suggested strength. There was something manic about him, a hint of tension in his gestures. His eyes were restless, and he tended to stare off to one side when he spoke, as if direct eye contact made him anxious. The woman was in her early 20s, with a wide mouth, strong chin, and a pug nose that looked as if it was made of putty. She wore no makeup, and her fair hair was dense, a series of tight ripples that she wore shoulder length, brittle and ill-cut. Her skin was very pale, mottled with freckles. She was wearing a man's oversized silk bathrobe and apparently nursing a cold. She kept a wad of Kleenex in her pocket, which she hunked into from time to time. She was so close to me I could see the chapping where the frequent blowing had reddened her nose and upper lip. I wondered if she was an old girlfriend of Billy's. There was no overt sexuality in the way they related to one another, but there was a curious intimacy. An old love affair gone flat, perhaps. The continuous rock and roll music was driving me nuts. I was never going to hear what they were saying with that stuff booming out all over the place. I got down off the steps and went around the other side of the trailer to the front door. The window to the right was wide open, though the curtains were pinned shut. I waited until there was a brief pause between cuts. I took a deep breath and pounded on the door. "Hey, could you cut the goddamn noise?" I yelled. "We're trying to get some sleep over here." From inside the trailer, the woman hollered, "Sorry." The music ceased abruptly, and I went back around to the other side to see how much of their conversation I could pick up. The quiet was divine. The volume on the television set must have been turned all the way down, because the string of commercials that now appeared was antic with silence, and I could actually catch snatches of what they were saying, though they mumbled unmercifully.
"Course, she's going to say that. What did you expect?" she said.
I don't like the pressure. I don't like having her on my back.
He said something else I couldn't make out.
What difference does it make? Nobody forced her. Shit, she's free, white, and 21. The point is, getting into. Just so she doesn't think.
The whole thing, right?
Her voice had dropped, and when Billy answered, he had one hand across his mouth so I couldn't understand him at all. He was only half attentive anyway, talking to her with his gaze straying to the television picture. It must have been 11 o'clock because the local news came on. There was the usual lead-in, a long shot of the news desk with two male newscasters, one black, one white, like a matched set, sitting there in suits. Both looked properly solemn. The camera cut to a headshot of the black man. A photograph of John Daggett appeared briefly behind him. There was a quick shot of the beach. It took me a moment to realize that it must have been the spot where Daggett's body had been found. In the background, I could see the mouth of the harbor and the dredge. Billy jerked upright, grabbing the woman's arm. She swiveled around to see what he was pointing to. The announcer talked on, smoothly moving the top sheet of paper aside. The camera cut to the co-anchor, and the picture shifted to a still shot of a local waste disposal site. Billy and the woman traded a long, anxious look. Billy started cracking his knuckles.
Christ!
The woman snatched up the paper and tossed it at him.
I told you it was him the minute I read some bum washed up on the beach. God damn it, Billy! Everything with you comes down to the same old bullshit. You think you're so smart. You got all the angles covered. Oh, sure. Turns out you don't even know what you're talking about.
They don't even know we knew him. How would they know that?
She gave him a scornful look, exasperated that he tried to defend himself.
Give the cop some credit. They probably identified him by his fingerprints, right? So they know he was up in San Luis. It's not going to take a genius to figure out you were up there with him.
Next thing we know, somebody's coming around knocking at the door. When'd you last see this guy? Shit like that.
He got up abruptly. He crossed to a kitchen cabinet and opened it. You got any blackjack?
No, I don't have any blackjack. You drank it all last night.
Get some clothes on. Let's go over to the hub.
Billy, I've got a cold. I'm not going out at this hour. You go. Why do you need a drink anyway?
He reached for his jacket, hunching into it.
You have any cash? All I got on me is a buck.
Get a job. Pay your own way. I'm tired of giving you money.
I said you'd get it back. What are you worried about?
Come on, come on,
he said, snapping his fingers impatiently. She took her time about it, but she did root through her purse, coming up with a crumpled $5 bill, which he took without comment.
Are you crashing here? She asked.
I don't know yet. Probably. Don't lock up.
Well, just keep it down, okay? I feel like hell, and I don't want to be woke up.
He put his hands on her arms.
Hey, he said. Cool it. You worry too much.
You know what your problem is? You think all you have to do is say shit like that and it's all okay. The world doesn't work that way. It never did.
Yeah, well, there's always a first time. Your problem is you're a pessimist.
At that point, I figured I'd better cut out and head back to my car. I eased down off my perch, debating briefly about whether I should move the steps or leave them there. Better to move them. I hefted them, swiftly pushing through the undergrowth to a cleared space where the junk was stacked up. I set the box down and then took off through the darkened trailer park and out to the street. I jogged to my car, started it, and did another U-turn, anticipating that Billy would head back the same way he came. Sure enough, in my rear-view mirror, I saw the Chevrolet make a left turn onto the main thoroughfare coming up behind me. He followed me for a block and a half, tailgating, a real A-type. With another impatient toot of the horn, he passed me, squealed into another left-hand turn, and zoomed off toward Milagro. I knew where he was headed, so I took my time. There's a bar called The Hub about 3 blocks up. I walked into the place maybe 10 minutes after he did. He'd already bought his Jack Daniels, which he was nursing while he played pool. Chapter 9. The Hub is a bar with all the ambience of a converted warehouse. The space is too vast for camaraderie, the air too chill for relaxation. The ceiling is high, painted black, and covered with a gridwork of pipes and electrical conduits. The tables in the main room are sparse, the walls lined with old black-and-white photographs of the bar and its various clientele over the years. Through a wide archway is a smaller room with 4 pool tables. The jukebox is massive, outlined in bands of yellow, green, and cherry red, with bubbles blipping through the seams.
The place was curiously empty for a Saturday night. A Willie Nelson single was playing, but it wasn't one I knew. I was the only woman in the bar, and I could sense the male attention shift to me with a bristling caution. I paused, feeling sniffed at, as if I were a dog in an alien neighborhood. Cigarette smoke hung in the air, and the men with their pool cues were caught in the hazy light, bent over the tables in silhouette. I identified Billy Polo by the great puff of hair around his head. Upright, he was taller than I pictured him, with wide, hard shoulders and slim hips. He was playing pool with a Mexican kid, maybe 22, with a gaunt face, tattooed arms, and a strip of pinched-looking chest which was visible in the gap of the Hawaiian shirt he wore unbuttoned to the waist. He sported maybe 6 chest hairs and a shallow depression in the middle of his sternum. I crossed to the table and stood there, waiting for Billy to finish his game. He glanced at me with disinterest and lined up the cue ball with the 6 ball, which he smacked smartly into a side pocket. He moved around the table without pause, lining up the 2 ball, which he fired like a shot into the corner pocket. He chalked his cue, eyeing the 3 ball. He tested an angle and rejected it, leaning into the table then with a shot that sent the 3 ball rocketing into the side pocket, while the 5 ball glanced off the side, rolled into range of the corner pocket, hung there, and finally dropped in. A trace of a smile crossed Billy's face, but he didn't look up. Meanwhile, the Mexican kid stood there and grinned at me, leaning on his cue stick. He mouthed, "I love you." One of his front teeth was rimmed in gold like a picture frame, and there was a smudge of blue chalk near his chin. Behind him, Billy cleaned up the table and put his cue stick back in the rack on the wall. As he passed, he plucked a 20 from the kid's shirt pocket and tucked it into his own. Then, with his face averted, he said,
"You the chick came looking for me at my mom's house earlier?"
"That's right. I'm a friend of John Daggett's." He cocked his head, squinting, his right hand cupped behind his ear.
"Who?"
I smiled lazily. We were apparently playing charades. I raised my voice, enunciating. "Daggett. John."
"Oh, yeah, him. How's he doing these days?"
He started snapping his fingers lightly to the music, which had switched from Willie Nelson to a George Benson tune.
"He's dead."
I have to credit him. He did a nice imitation of casual surprise, not overdoing it.
"You're shitting me. Daggett's dead? Too bad. What happened to the dude? Heart attack?"
"Drowned. It just happened last night down at the marina." I wagged a thumb over my shoulder in the direction of the beach so he'd know which marina I meant.
"Here in town? Hey, that's tough. I didn't know that. He was in L.A. last I heard."
"I'm surprised you didn't see it on the news."
"Yeah, well, I never pay attention to that shit, you know. Bums me out. I got better things to do with my time."
His eyes were all over the place, and his body was half turned away. I had to guess that he was busy trying to figure out who I was and what I was up to. He flicked a look at me.
"I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name."
"Kinsey Milhone." He studied me fleetingly.
"I thought my mom said the name was Charlene."
I shook my head.
"I don't know where she got that." "And you do what?"
"Basic research. I freelance. What's that got to do with it?"
"You don't look like a friend of Daggett's. He was kind of a lowlife. You got too much class for a scumbag like him."
"I didn't say we were close. I met him recently through a friend of a friend."
"Why, tell me about it. I don't give a damn."
"Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Daggett said if anything happened to him, I should talk to you."
"Me? Nah," he said with disbelief. "That's fucking weird. You must have got me mixed up with somebody else. I mean, I knew Daggett, but I didn't know him, you dig?"
"That's funny. He told me you were the best of friends." He smiled and shook his head.
"Old Daggett gave you a bum steer, baby doll. I don't know nothing about it. I don't even remember when I saw him last. Long time.
What was the occasion?" He glanced at the Mexican kid who was eavesdropping shamelessly.
"Catch you later, man," he said to him.
Then under his breath, with contempt, he said,
"Paco."
Apparently this was a generic insult that applied to all Hispanics. He touched my elbow, steering me into the other room.
"These beaners are all the same," he confided. "Think they know how to play pool, but they can't do shit.
I don't like talking personal in front of Spicks. Can I buy you a beer?
Sure.
He indicated an empty table and held a chair out for me. I hung my slicker over the back and sat down. He caught the bartender's eye and held up two fingers. The bartender pulled out two bottles of beer, which he opened and set on the bar. Billy said,
"You want anything else? Potato chips? They make real nice French fries. Kind of greasy, but good."
I shook my head, watching him with interest. At close range, he had a curious charisma, a crude sexuality that he probably wasn't even aware of. I meet men like that occasionally, and I'm always startled by the phenomenon. He ambled over and picked up the beers, dropping a couple of crumpled bills on the bar. He said something to the bartender and then waited while the guy placed a glass upside down on each bottle, shooting a smirk in my direction. He came back to the table and sat down.
"Jesus, ask for a glass in this place and they act like you're putting on airs. Bunch of bohunks. I only hang out here because I got a sister works here 3 nights a week.
Ah, I thought, the woman in the trailer. He poured one of the beers and pushed it over to me, taking his time then as he poured his own. His eyes were deep set, and he had dimples that formed a crease on either side of his mouth.
"Look," he said, "I can see you got your mind made up. I know something I don't. The truth is, I didn't like Daggett much, and I don't think he liked me. Where you got this yarn about me being some pal of his, I don't know. But it wasn't from him."
"You called him Monday morning, didn't you?"
"Nuh-uh, not me. Why would I call him?"
I went on as though he hadn't said anything. "I don't know what you told him, but he was scared."
"Sorry, I can't help you out. Must have been somebody else. What was he doing up here anyway?"
"I don't know. His body washed up in the surf this morning. I thought maybe you could fill me in on the rest. Do you have any idea where he was last night?"
"Nope, not a clue."
He'd gotten interested in a speck of dust in the foam on his beer, and he had to pick that out. "When did you see him last? I don't think you said." His tone became facetious.
"Jeez, I don't have my daytimer with me. Otherwise, I could pin it down. We might have had lunch at some little out-of-the-way place, just him and me.
San Luis, perhaps?" There was a slight pause, and his smile dimmed a couple of watts.
"I was at San Luis with him," he said cautiously. "Me and 3,700 other guys, so what?"
"I thought maybe you'd kept in touch."
"I can tell you didn't know Daggett too good. Being with him is like walking around with dog dew on your shoe, you know? It's not something you'd seek out."
"Who else did he know here in town?"
"Can't help you there. It's not my week to keep track."
"What about your sister? Did he know her?"
"Coral? No way. She don't hang out with bums like that. I'd break her neck."
"I don't get why you're going on and on about this. I told you I don't know nothing. I didn't see him, didn't hear from him. Why can't you just take my word for it?"
"Because I don't think you're telling the truth." "Says who? I mean, you came looking for me, remember? I don't have to talk to you. I'm doing you a favor." "I don't know who you are. I don't even know what the fuck you're up to."
I shook my head, smiling slightly.
"God, Billy, such foul talk. I didn't think you dealt with women that way. I'm shocked."
"Now you're making fun of me, right?" He scrutinized my face. "You some kind of cop?"
I ran my thumbnail down the bottle, snagging an accordion strip of label, which I picked off.
"Actually, I am."
He snorted. Now he'd heard everything. "Come on, like what?" he said.
"I'm a private investigator."
"Bullshit.
It's a fact."
He tipped back in his chair, amused that I'd try to lay such a line on him. "Jesus, you're too much. Who do you think you're talking to? I might have been born at night, but it wasn't last night. I know the private eyes around town, and you ain't one, so try something else."
I laughed.
"All right, I'm not. Maybe I'm just a nosy chick looking into the death of a man I once met." "Now, that I'd buy, but it still don't explain why you're cranking on my case."
"You introduced him to Lavella, didn't you?"
That stopped him momentarily. "You know Lavella?"
"Sure. I met her down in L.A. She has an apartment on Sawtell."
"When was this?"
"Day before yesterday."
"No fooling. And she told you to look me up?"
"How else would I know where you were?"
He stared at me, going through some sort of mental debate. I thought a little coaxing might loosen his tongue. "Are you aware that Daggett's been beating the shit out of her?"
That made him restless, and his eyes dropped away from mine. Yeah, well, Lavella's a big girl. She has to learn how to take care of herself.
Why don't you help her out? He smiled bitterly.
I know people who'd laugh at the notion of me helping anyone, he said. Besides, she's tough. You don't want to underestimate that one, I'm telling you.
You've known her a long time, haven't you?
His knee had started to jump.
7 years, eight. I met her when she was 17. We lived together for a while, but it didn't work out. We used to knock heads too much.
She's a bull-headed bitch, but I loved her a lot. Then I got busted on a burglary rap, and me and her, hell, I don't know what it was. We wrote to each other for a while, but you can't go back to something once it's dead, you know? Anyway, now we're friends, I guess. At least I dig her. I don't know how she feels about me.
Have you seen her recently?
The knee stopped.
No, I haven't seen her recently, he said.
What about you? Why'd you go down there?
I was looking for Daggett. The phone was disconnected.
What exactly did she say?
I shrugged. Nothing much. I wasn't there long, and she wasn't feeling that good. She was nursing a big black eye.
Jesus, he said.
He rocked back in his chair.
Tell me something.
How come women do that? Let guys punch 'em out?
I have no idea.
He drained his beer glass and set it down.
I bet you don't take crap from anyone, am I right?
We all take crap from someone, I said.
Billy got up.
Sorry to cut this off, but I got a split.
He turned, tucking his shirt down into his pants more securely. His body language said he'd already taken off and hoped his clothing would catch up with him by the time he hit the street. I got up, reaching for my slicker.
You're not leaving town, are you?
What business is it of yours?
It doesn't seem like a good idea with Daggett's death hanging fire. Suppose the cops want to talk to you.
About what?
Where you were last night, for starters.
His tone rose.
Where I was? What are you talking about?
They might want to know about the connection between Daggett and you.
What connection? That's a crock. I don't know where you come up with that.
It's not me you have to worry about. It's the cops who count.
What cops?
I shook my head. You know who your friendly local cops are, I said. If somebody puts a bug in the wrong ear, you'll be sitting in the hot seat.
He was all outrage. Why would you do that to me?
Because you're not leveling with me, William.
I am leveling with you. I've told you everything I know.
I don't think so. I think you knew about Daggett's death. I think you saw him this week. He put his hands on his hips and looked off across the room, shaking his head.
Man, this is all I need. This is no lie. I've been straight. I'm minding my own business, doing like I've been told. I didn't even know the dude was up here.
You can stick to your story if you like, I said. But I'll give you a word of advice. I've got the license number of that car you bought. You bolt, and I'm calling Lieutenant Dolan down at Homicide.
He seemed as much puzzled as dismayed. What is this, a shakedown? Is that what this is about?
What's to shake? You don't have a cent. I want information, that's all.
I don't have any information. How many times I got to tell you that?
Look, I said patiently, why don't I let you think about the situation and then we can talk again?
Why don't you go fuck yourself?
I put my slicker on, tucking the strap of my handbag over my shoulder. Thanks for the beer. I'll buy yours next time. He made an exaggerated gesture of dismissal, too pissed off to reply. He headed toward the door and I watched him go. I glanced at my watch. It was well after midnight, and I was exhausted. My head was starting to ache, and I knew everything about me smelled like stale cigarette smoke. I wanted to go home, strip down, shower, and then crawl into the folds of my quilt. Instead, I took a deep breath and went after him.
End of Disc 2. Disc 3.
Chapter 10. I gave him a good head start, then followed him back to the trailer. The temperature felt like it had dropped into the 50s. The eucalyptus trees were still tossing occasional showers at me when the wind cut through, but for the most part the night was clear. Above me I could see pale puffs of rain cloud receding, wide patches of starry sky breaking through. I parked half a block away and padded into the park on foot as I had before. Billy's car was parked beside the trailer. I was getting bored, but I had to be certain he wasn't heading off to consult with some Confederate I didn't know about. The same lights were on in the galley, but a dim light now glowed at the rear of the trailer where I imagined the bedroom to be. I picked my way through the bushes to that end. Curtains were pulled across the windows, but the venting system was piping a murmured conversation right out through a mesh-covered opening. I hunkered down by the torn skirting, leaning my head against the aluminum. I could smell cigarette smoke, which I guessed was Coral's.
"Want to know why she showed up now?" she was saying. "That's what we have to worry about. For all we know, they're in it together."
"Yeah, but doing what? That's what I can't figure out."
"When'd she say she'd get in touch?"
"She didn't. Said I should think about the situation.
Jesus! How'd she get a beat on the Chevy so fast? That's what bugs me. I had that car 2 hours." "Maybe she followed you, dimwit."
The silence was profound.
"God damn it," he said.
I heard footsteps thump toward the front of the trailer. By the time the door banged open, I was easing my way around the end. I peered out into the carport. The nose of the Chevy was about 6 feet away, the space on either side of it crowded with junk. The door to the trailer had been flung open. Light poured out, washing as far as the point where the asphalt began. With a quick look over my shoulder, I waded into the refuse, picking my way around to the far side of the car, where I crouched, listening intently. Sometimes I feel like I spend half my life this way. I heard Billy fumble his way around the bedroom end of the trailer just as I had.
"Jesus!"
he hissed. Coral peered out the side window, whispering hoarsely.
"What's wrong?"
"Shut up, nothing. I banged my goddamn shin on the trailer hitch. Why don't you clean up this crap?"
"My sentiments exactly." Coral laughed and the curtain dropped back into place. Billy appeared again at the far end of the carport, rubbing his left shin. He did a quick visual survey, apparently convinced by then there wasn't anybody lurking about the premises. He shook his head and thumped up the steps, banging the door shut behind him. The carport went dark. I let out my breath. I could hear them murmuring together, but by then I didn't really care what else they discussed. As soon as I was convinced it was safe, I crept out of the driveway and headed for my car. Sunday morning was overcast. The very air looked gray, and dampness seemed to rise up out of the earth like a mist. I went through my usual morning routine, getting a 3-mile run in before the skies opened up again. At 9 o'clock, I put a call through to Barbara Daggett at home. I brought her up to date, filling her in on my night's activities. "What now?" she asked. "I'm going to let Billy Polo stew for a day or two and then get back to him."
"What makes you think he won't skip?"
"Well, he is on parole, and I'm hoping he won't want to mess that up. Besides, it feels like a waste of money to pay me to sit there all day."
"I thought you said he was the only lead you had."
"Maybe not," I said cautiously. "I've been thinking about Tony Gayen and the other people killed in the accident."
"Tony Gayen?" she said with surprise. "How could he be involved in this?"
"I don't know. Your father hired me originally to track him down. Maybe he found the kid himself, and that's where he was early in the week."
"But, Kinsey, why would Daddy want to track him down? That boy must hate his guts. His whole family was wiped out."
"That's my point."
"Oh. Do you have any idea how to locate him? Your father had an address on Stanley Place, but the house was apparently empty. I can't find a gay enlisted in the telephone book." "He lives with his aunt now, I think, somewhere in Colgate. Let me see if I've got an address."
Colgate is the bedroom community, attached to Santa Teresa like a double star. The two are just about the same size, but Santa Teresa has all the character, and Colgate has the affordable housing, along with hardware stores, paint companies, bowling alleys, and drive-in theaters. Colgate is the frosty freeze capital of the world. There was a pause, and I could hear pages rattle. She came back on the line.
"My mistake. They live near the museum. Her last name is Westfall. Ramona."
"I wonder why your father didn't know about her."
"I don't know. She was there for the trial. I do remember that, because someone pointed her out to me. I wrote her a note afterwards, saying that of course we'd do anything we could to help, but I never heard back."
"You know anything else about her? Is she married, for instance?"
"I think so, yes. Her husband manufactures industrial supplies, or something like that. Actually, now that I think about it, she was working at that kitchenware place on Capilla, because I spotted her when I was in there shopping a couple of months ago. Maybe you could catch her this afternoon if she still works there."
"On Sunday?"
"Sure, they're open from 12 to 5.
"I'll try her first and see how far I get," I said. "What about your mother? How's she holding up?"
"Surprisingly well. Turns out she handles death like a champ.
If it's covered in the Bible, she trots out all the appropriate attitudes and goes through the sequence automatically. I thought she'd flip out, but it seems to have put her back on her feet. She's got church women sitting with her, and the pastor's there. The kitchen table's stacked with tuna casseroles and chocolate cakes. I don't know how long it will last, but for now she's in her element.
When's the funeral?
Tuesday afternoon. The body's been transported to the mortuary. I think they said he'd be ready for viewing early this afternoon.
Are you coming by?
Yes, I think I will. I can tell you then if I've talked to this Westfall woman or the kid. Jordan's is a gourmet cook's fantasy, with every imaginable food preparation device. Rack after rack of cookware, utensils, cookbooks, linens, spices, coffees, and condiments. Chafing dishes, wicker baskets, exotic vinegars and oils, knives, baking pans, glassware. I stood in the entrance for a moment, amazed by the number and variety of food-related implements. Pasta machines, cappuccino makers, food warmers, coffee grinders, ice cream freezers, food processors. The air smelled of chocolate and made me wish I had a mother. I spotted three saleswomen, all wearing wraparound aprons made of mattress ticking, with the store's name embroidered in maroon across the bib. I asked for Ramona Westfall and was directed toward the rear aisle. She was apparently doing a shelf count. I found her perched on a small wooden stool, clipboard in hand, checking off items on a list that included most of the non-electrical gadgets. She was sorting through a bin of what looked like small stainless steel sliding boards, with a blade across the center that would slice your tiny ass off.
"What are those?" I asked.
She glanced up at me with a pleasant smile. She appeared to be in her late 40s, with short, pale, sandy hair, streaked with gray, hazel eyes peering at me over a pair of half-glasses which she wore low on her nose. She used little, if any, makeup, and even seated, I could tell she was small and slim. Under the apron she wore a white, long-sleeved blouse with a Peter Pan collar, a gray tweed skirt, hose, and penny loafers.
"That's a mandolin. It's made in West Germany."
I thought a mandolin was a musical instrument.
"This spelling's different. This is for slicing raw vegetables. You can waffle cut or julienne."
"Really?" I said. I had sudden visions of homemade French fries and coleslaw, neither of which I've ever prepared. "How much is that?"
$110. With the slicing guard, it's $138. Would you like a demonstration?
I shook my head, unwilling to spend that much money on behalf of a potato. She got to her feet, smoothing the front of her apron. She was half a head shorter than I, and smelled like a perfume sample I'd gotten in the mail the week before. Lavender and crushed jasmine. I was impressed with the price of the stuff, if not the scent. I stuck it in a drawer, and I'm assailed with the fragrance now every time I pull out fresh underwear.
"You're Ramona Westfall, aren't you?"
Her smile was modified to a look of expectancy.
"That's right. Have we met?"
I shook my head. "I'm Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator here in town."
"Is there something I can help you with?"
"I'm looking for Tony Gahan. I understand you're his aunt."
"Tony? Good heavens, what for?"
"I was asked to locate him on a personal matter. I didn't know how else to get in touch with him."
"What personal matter? I don't understand."
"I was asked to deliver something to him, a check from a man who's recently deceased." She looked at me blankly for a moment, and then I saw recognition leap in her eyes.
"You're referring to John Daggett, aren't you? Someone told me it was on the news last night. I assumed he was still in prison."
"He's been out for 6 weeks." Her face flooded with color.
"Well, isn't that typical?" she snapped. "5 people dead and he's back on the streets."
"Not quite," I said. "Could we go someplace and talk?"
"About what? About my sister? She was 38, a beautiful person. She was decapitated when he ran a stoplight and plowed into them. Her husband was killed. Tony's sister was crushed. She was 6, just a baby."
She bit off her sentence abruptly, suddenly aware that her voice had risen. Nearby, several people paused, looking over at us.
"Who are the others? Did you know them?" I asked. "You're the detective. You figure it out."
In the next aisle, a dark-haired woman in a striped apron caught her eye. She didn't open her mouth, but her expression said, "Is everything all right?"
"I'm taking a break," Ramona said to her. "I'll be in the back room if Trish is looking for me."
The dark-haired woman glanced at me briefly and then dropped her gaze. Ramona was moving toward a doorway on the far side of the room. I followed. The other customers had lost interest, but I had a feeling that I'd be facing an unpleasant scene. By the time I entered the back room, Ramona was fumbling in her handbag with shaking hands. She opened a zippered compartment and took out a vial of pills. She extracted a tablet and broke it in half, drowning it with a slug of cold coffee from a white mug with her name on the side. On second thought, she took the second half of the tablet as well. I said, "Look, I'm sorry to have to bring this up."
"Don't apologize," she spat. "It doesn't do any good."
She searched through the bag and came up with a hard pack of Winston's. She pulled out a cigarette and tamped it repeatedly on her thumbnail, then lit it with a Bic disposable lighter she'd tucked in her apron pocket. She hugged her waist with her left arm, propping the right elbow on it so she could hold the cigarette near her face. Her eyes seemed to have darkened, and she fixed me with a blank, rude stare.
"What is it you want?"
I could feel my face warm. Somehow the money was suddenly beside the point and seemed like too paltry a sum in any event. "I have a cashier's check for Tony. John Daggett asked me to deliver it." Her smile was supercilious.
"Oh, a check. Well, how much is it for? Is it per head or some sort of lump sum payment by the carload?"
"Mrs. Westfall," I said patiently,
"you can call me Ramona, dear, since the subject matter's so intimate. We're talking about the people I love best in this world."
She took a deep drag of her cigarette and blew smoke toward the ceiling. I clamped down on my temper, controlling my response. "I understand that the subject is painful," I said. "I know there's no way to compensate for what happened, but John Daggett was making a gesture, and regardless of your opinion of him, it's possible that Tony might have a use for the money."
"We provide for him very nicely, thanks. We don't need anything from John Daggett or his daughter or from you."
I plowed on, heading into the face of her wrath like a swimmer through churning surf. "Let me just say something first. Daggett came to me last week with a cashier's check made out to Tony." She started to speak, but I held up one hand. "Please," I said. She subsided, allowing me to continue. "I put the check in a safe deposit box until I could figure out how to deliver it, as agreed. You can toss it in the trash for all I care, but I'd like to do what I said I'd do, which is to see that Tony Gahan gets it. In theory, it's Tony's to do with as he sees fit, so I'd appreciate it if you'd talk to him before you do anything else." She thought about that one, her eyes locked on mine.
"How much?"
$25,000. That's a good chunk of education for Tony, or a trip abroad."
"I get the point," she cut in. "Now maybe you'll allow me to have my say. That boy has been with us for almost 3 years now. He's 15 years old, and I don't think he's slept a full 8 hours since the accident. He has migraines, he bites his nails, his grades are poor, school attendance is shit. We're talking about a kid with an IQ right off the charts. He's a wreck, and John Daggett did that to him. There's no way, no way anyone can ever make up to Tony for what that man did."
"I understand that."
"No, you don't."
Her eyes filled suddenly with tears. She was silent, hands shaking again so badly now that she could scarcely get the Winston to her lips. She managed to take another drag, fighting for control. The silence lengthened. She seemed to shudder, and I could almost see the tranquilizer kick in. She turned away abruptly, dropped the cigarette, and stepped on it.
"Give me a number where I can reach you. I'll talk to my husband and see what he says."
I handed her my card, taking a moment to jot down my home address and telephone number on the back, in case she needed to reach me there. Chapter 11. After I left Ramona Westfall, I stopped by my apartment and changed into pantyhose, low heels, and my all-purpose dress. This garment, which I've owned for 5 years, is made of some magic fabric that doesn't wilt, wrinkle, or show dirt. It can be squashed down to the size of a rain hat and shoved in the bottom of my handbag without harm. It can also be rinsed out in any bathroom sink and hung to dry overnight. It's black, lightweight, has long sleeves, zips up the back, and should probably be accessorized. A woman's clothing concept I've never understood. I wear the dress as is, and it always looks okay to me. Once in a while I see this look of recognition in someone's eye, but maybe it's just a moment of surprise at seeing me in something other than jeans and boots. The Winnington Blake Mortuary, burials, cremation, and shipping, serving all faiths, is located on the east side of town on a shady side street with ample parking. It was originally built as a residence and retains the feeling of a substantial single-family dwelling. Now, of course, the entire first floor has been converted into the equivalent of 6 spacious living rooms, each furnished with metal folding chairs and labeled with some serene-sounding word. The gentleman who greeted me, a Mr. Sharonson,